We are currently looking for storytellers for the next Tell Us Something storytelling event. The theme is a sense of place. If you'd like to pitch your story for consideration, please call 406-203-4683. You have 3 minutes to leave your pitch. Our friends from the deaf community are welcome to pitch by emailing info@tellussomething.org. The pitch deadline is May 21st. I look forward to hearing from you. Welcome to the Tell Us Something podcast. Tell Us Something is a nonprofit that helps people share their true personal stories around the theme, live in person without notes. I'm Mark Moss, your host and executive director of Tell Us Something. Sometimes adventure is chosen. Sometimes it's thrust upon you. In this episode of the Tell Us Something podcast, we delve into the journeys of four remarkable people. A father on a wilderness backpacking trip must trust his 9-year-old daughter to decide if they push through a grueling trail or turn back.
You got these black burned trees. You got the fireweed that's about yay high, that pink bright fireweed, the just juxtaposition with that and the trees. It's just gorgeous.
A young woman chasing a childhood dream unexpectedly lands a job at an Alaskan salmon hatchery, finding her true calling far from the world of fashion.
When you're 19, details like where the job is and the fact that you should be within an hour of a hospital a lot of times really don't matter.
Meanwhile, a mountain guide's attempt at romance is derailed by a giant stake and a dramatic breakup he must fight to fix.
I noticed a little green sheen on the surface of that meat. But I just flipped it over and thought, I'll cook it real well.
Finally, a teacher overwhelmed by her daughter's cancer fight accepts a risky Peace Corps invitation to Africa, fundamentally changing how she views her life's responsibilities.
My favorite trick was the guy who spun plates. He'd have this stick, and he'd get the plate going up there, and he'd get it spinning, and then he'd put it in this matrix. And as that matrix held the plate, he'd keep it going, and he'd get 10 or 12 plates going at one time.
Four storytellers shared their true personal story on the theme, Walk on the Wild Side. Our stories today were recorded live in person in front of a packed house on October 7th, 2025 at the George and Jane Dennison Theater. Remember this, Tell Us Something stories sometimes have adult themes. Storytellers sometimes use adult language. Please take care of yourselves. The University of Montana, where the George and Jane Dennison Theater is located, stands on the Aboriginal territories of the Salish and Kalispell people. We also recognize the Kootenai, the Blackfeet, the Shoshone, and the many other indigenous peoples who have called this place home and whose histories, cultures, and languages continue to enrich our community. When we recorded this episode of the podcast, the aspens were turning gold and the air was crisp. It was a sacred time of transition. For generations, the original stewards of this valley understood autumn as a time for the final harvests, for preparing food and medicine for the coming cold, for the last hunts before the snow, and for gathering to share stories that will sustain the community through the winter. This land is not a relic of the past. It is a living, breathing entity, deeply connected to the ongoing lives and traditions of indigenous peoples. In our first story, Lan Tawny seizes the chance for an epic backpacking trip into the Frank Church Wilderness, made even better by the inclusion of his 9-year-old daughter and support llamas. When the intense summer heat and rugged trail push the young girl to the brink of giving up, he must trust her to make the decision to push forward or turn back. Lan calls his story Young Grit. Thanks for listening.
All right, so I get this call from my friend Ryan. It's the most amazing call ever, and he says, hey, do you want to go down to the Frank Church Wilderness No Return on a backpack trip? And I was like, heck yeah. And then he says something even better. He says, it's going to be supported by llamas, and so we don't have to carry anything on our backs. And I was like, hell yeah. So then I ask him, like, well, what are the dates? So he tells me the dates. I start running through my head, okay, it's not my anniversary, but it's in the July. Oh, man, I'm sorry, I can't go. He's like, why can't you go? I'm like, it's my daughter Sydney's 10th birthday. So I'd gone from just so excited, just, I can't go. And without skipping a beat, he says, well, why don't you bring her? And I was like, yeah, I mean, she's 9, almost 10. Yeah, I think she could probably do it. So I get off the phone, and I wait for my wife to come home, and I talk to her about this trip that's been offered. And she's like, yeah, I think she can do it. Since Sydney gets home, I think she was hanging at a friend's house, and she gets home, and before it's even all the way out of my mouth, she's like, Dad, I want to do it. So now we have this opportunity, dad and daughter, to go into the Frank Church Wilderness of No Return. And so we start training up on Mount Sentinel. And I buy her a backpack. Even though we're going to have these llamas, I want to make sure that she's got water. I want to make sure she has snacks. Plus, I want her to carry something as she goes into the first time into the wilderness. So we're up on Mount Sentinel. We're hiking. She's getting strong. Feels good. And so the day comes, and we drive. You know, it's a long drive. So we get up early in the morning, and we drive down to Stanley. It's about, I don't know, about another hour outside of Stanley. And we get to the trailhead, and it's this just craziness of llamas and gear everywhere. And so we get there, and we give them our stuff, and they pack it into a llama. And we all get assigned a llama. And so what we're going to do is we're going to hike up this trail, and we're going to all have our own llama, and we're going to take them up to the top of this high mountain lake. It's about a 3-mile hike. First mile is going to be flat. Next two are kind of steep to get over the top of that ridge. If you've been in the woods, you know you got to get over that ridge usually to get to that lake. So it's this chaos, but then Sydney gets assigned her llama. His name is Marshall. Marshall is this old seasoned llama. He's been around the block. I think he gets assigned to Sydney because she's the youngest one in the group by far. And so we get all packed up, and now it's time to go. And so we're going down the trail. And what I haven't told you yet is this is the middle of July, and it is hot as Hades. Like, I'm talking hot. It's about noon. The sun is beating down on us. We're in a place that is recently burned, so it's absolutely gorgeous. You got these black burned trees. You got the fireweed that's about yay high, that pink bright fireweed, the just juxtaposition with that and the trees. It's just gorgeous. So we're walking along this trail, and you know, it's been hot for a while, and so there's this dust on the trail. So as you're walking, it's like this dust just comes up in the air. Think about like Pigpen and Peanuts. We're like this mass of llamas and people and dust. Sid's not bothered by it. She's having the time of her life. She's smiling. She's singing. I'm like, this is amazing. So that's that flat part. Yeah. So then we take this hard left, and that's when we start to get a little bit steeper. Now, at the same time, Marshall decides to eat some of that fireweed. Fireweed makes him slobber, like uncontrollably slobbering. So he's slobbering down the back of her leg. This is the first sign that things are changing a little bit. Sydney's like, that's gross. And I'm like, ah, it's okay. It's just llama juice. And so we keep going. And then, you know, since there's a recent burn, there's a ton of downfall, like a ton of downfall. And over one of these logs, Sydney has, she's got Marshall behind her, and she goes over this log while this llama steps on the back of her calf, and I hear it kind of scream. Now, my first thought is, if this is a horse, like, it's trip over. Horses with their hooves, they can't really feel what they're touching, and that would have crushed her calf. Been a serious, serious injury. But llamas, they have these two toes, and they can feel with those toes. It's like her fingers. So when it touches that calf, it just bounces off. So all it did was scare. So we avoided that mess. But as I said, it's starting to get steep. And, you know, Sydney, she stops talking. And we're both big-time motor mouths, talking all the time. And when she stops talking, something's wrong. So I look at Sid, and I'm like, hey, you okay? She's like, oh, I'm kind of getting tired. And so we give her some water, a little bit of a snack. And I ask our leader, there's about 13 other people with us, and asked the leader of this trip, I said, how much longer till lunch? Because I know we're stopping for lunch. And he's like, oh, just 20 more minutes. So I looked at Sid, and I said, can you make it 20 more minutes? She's like, yes. So we continue up the trail. Well, if you've ever been in the woods with people, that 20 minutes turns into 30 minutes, turns into 45 minutes before we stop. So we stop, and she's absolutely had it. Her face is bright red. She's on the verge of tears. As a father, I'm looking at that, man, I've ruined her. This is her experience in the woods, and what an idiot. But there's this creek that's running along right there. Comes out of that high mountain lake. It's nice and cold. I'm like, ah, she needs to cool down. So I pick her up, and I dunk her in that water, and I start shaking her. You can't shake a baby. You can shake a 9-year-old. I can tell you that. So she cools down a little bit. We get some food in her, but she's still, you can just see in her eyes, she's still not quite there. So I decided to tell her this story about Theodore Roosevelt. And Theodore Roosevelt in our family is revered. He's why we have these public lands that we have today. And so she's heard so many stories and probably is sick of telling or hearing these stories, but I'm like, I'm going to tell you another one. So when Roosevelt was young, he had asthma, like debilitating asthma. And back in that time, they didn't have inhalers. That ability to, you know, to get rid of kind of that episode that you're having. So what he decided to do, he decided to make himself strong in limb and strong in lung. So he spent a ton of time out in the woods doing just that, just tramping around the woods. And so he got over that affliction by facing it head on. So I tell her this story and I said, you got two options right now. We can turn around, we can go home, which is okay. Or we can face that adversity and we can move on. And I did the hardest thing I've probably ever done as a father. I walked away and let her think about that by herself. 9 years old. So I come back a couple minutes later, knowing full well if she wants to go home, we are going home. So I go, Sid, it's up to you. What do you want to do? She's like, I want to do it. I'm like, all right, we're going to do this. So we get up from lunch, and again, she's the youngest by far, and she gets Marshall, and Marshall's old, right? Like, he's this old seasoned llama. We got to get up to this high mountain lake, and we take off, and I will tell you what, we crush everybody else to the top. We're the first to the top. She gets up to the top, and she raises her hand like this, and she's just in triumph. I will never forget that image. So excited. And she strips down. She has her swimming suit on, which is probably one of the reasons why she was hot. But she jumps into this high mountain lake, and the ice off, you know, even though it's July, ice off had not happened not too long ago, and so it was freezing ass cold. She jumps in there, takes her breath away. Then she gets out, and she kind of stumbles because it's so cold, but she's got this huge smile on her face. Then she's getting out. She sees this little bug. We eat bugs at our house. It's kind of this weird thing that my dad started. He'd say, if fish eat them, I eat them. And so we've carried that tradition on. So she picks up this bug, and it's a stonefly nymph. If you've ever seen these, they're gigantic, and they look like aliens. She picks it up. She puts it in her mouth and starts chewing on it. And these people are like, what is going on? And it falls out of her mouth, and everybody laughs like you all just did. And she's like, oh yeah, and she goes and grabs it, and she picks it up, and she eats it. So this trip is, like, it's there's so many memories. We go out, there's somebody brought a blow-up kayak. We go out on this lake. The cutthroats, so we're just catching them hand over fist. She's in the front of this kayak. I'm watching this 9-year-old catch these fish. It's absolutely amazing. I've got a rod hanging out the back. These fish are trying to grab my fly, but I never get a chance to fish because she's catching them all. Next night is her birthday. We have her birthday cake in a Dutch oven. People sing her happy birthday. She's now 10 years old, and she did that in the wilderness. Look up at the stars that night. It's, you know, talking about all sorts of things. Just contemplating the universe by looking at all these stars. There's so many memories from that trip, but what I remember most is that grit that she showed in that moment of adversity. And sometimes, you know, you got to face that adversity and maybe take a step back and go home. But she instead, she found her inner self, her inner grit. Now she's here tonight. She's a senior in high school. She had her senior night tonight at soccer. I tell you, I didn't cry at that. I came close. But she's going to be going away to college next year. And undoubtedly, she's going to be facing adversity. And Cindy Claire, what I know is what you face on that mountain, what you've already faced in your life, you're always, always going to be able to face that adversity. I love you. Thank you.
Thanks, Land. Land Tawney is a fifth-generation Montanan prone to wandering and good times. Land earned his Bachelor of Science focused in wildlife biology from the University of Montana and has been working his entire adult life to conserve public lands and water and access to them at the local, state, and federal levels. From testifying in front of Congress in Washington, D.C., to organizing grassroots volunteers all across North America, Land walks the walk. He now co-chairs a new nonprofit, American Hunters and Anglers Action Network, and works tirelessly to protect our public lands for present and future generations. Next up, we have Haley Glassick, who was driven by a childhood dream of couture and must abandon fashion for a seemingly stable career path, only to have a single brochure unexpectedly reroute her life. A misunderstanding at a job interview for a job in Cordova, Alaska, plunges her into the grueling world of salmon hatcheries, where she finds her true calling in the remote wilderness. Haley calls her story Origin Story. Thanks for listening.
Hours would melt away as I spent time sketching clothes with colored pencil. I slowly built up a pretty large portfolio that included everything from wedding dresses to couture out there styles. I watched Devil Wears Prada more times than I can count and can recite the Cerulean Sweater monologue with a performance that rivals Meryl Streep. My senior year of high school, I designed and sewed my prom dress. It was a deep purple, one-shouldered taffeta gown with a pleated bodice and a crystal accent belt. The goal was, of course, to become a clothes designer, walking the streets of New York and showing in the most famous of fashion weeks. I applied to many universities, but only one design school. And all the universities provided some form of financial aid or scholarship, but the design school did not. I didn't want to go into massive amounts of debt in a field that was really cutthroat and had a low rate of success. So I decided to go to the University of Georgia, go Dogs, and shifted my focus to a career path that would arguably be just as glamorous, but much more stable. You know, the universal second career choice for all girls who don't go to design school. I would, of course, become a high school biology teacher. My freshman year, I wandered around the majors fair and ran into a table for the forestry school. I picked up a pamphlet that said Fisheries and Aquatic Sciences in big, bold word art letters above a photo with a bunch of smiling students holding up fish in a pristine-looking stream. The table was manned by a few upperclassmen wearing camo with deep southern accents and one professional advisor toting a mom haircut and wearing a red UGA logo polo that made 19-year-old me cringe. I asked the advisor if I could still be a biology teacher if I majored in fisheries. She said yes, and I declared my major. I quickly went to the bookstore and found a sale rack UGA logo camo hoodie. I decided at that moment that camo could be fashionable if it was intentional. That first summer, I wanted to apply to jobs in my new field. I had one fish class under my belt. I was ready to be a professional. I applied to over 100 jobs, and to my surprise, one of them emailed me back. They wanted to schedule an interview for a salmon hatchery bio aid position, and the address listed Cordova, AK. I thought, all right, some salmon in a tank in the middle of Arkansas. I mean, I've never been to Arkansas. It doesn't seem that cool. But I'll suck it up for this summer and get the experience under my belt. Now, at this time, I didn't know the difference between a trout and a bass. Sharks were still a mystery creature. Definitely not a mammal, but unclear if they were a fish. And so when interviewing as a 19-year-old for a hatchery job in so-called Arkansas, I didn't know that salmon had an intricate life history that included maturing in the ocean and migrating hundreds of miles back to their natal streams to spawn, die, and provide nutrients to the next generation of fish to perpetuate that miracle indefinitely. The first question they asked me during the interview was, "Are you comfortable and prepared with living in remote locations on islands in the Prince William Sound of Alaska?" Now, when you're 19, your reflexes are pretty quick. So I don't think they noticed my hesitation, as I realized the job was not in Cordova, Arkansas, but Cordova, Alaska. And I replied quickly, "Oh yeah, yeah, that's not gonna be an issue." They didn't need to know that my high school education clearly lacked geography and state abbreviations. And they also didn't need to know that just a few months earlier, I had been hospitalized and diagnosed with a chronic illness and was taking 10 pills a day to manage the symptoms. You know, when you're 19, details like where the job is and the fact that you should be within an hour of a hospital all the time really don't matter. I loaded onto a plane outside of Cordova with a suitcase full of thrifted flannel shirts, because that's what you wear in Alaska, 1,000 pills, and a DVD copy of The Devil Wears Prada. We took off, and I could see the shadow of the plane on the water and the hill slopes of the islands. And before I knew it, we were landing at the hatchery and hooked up to the dock, and the manager came out and shook my hand and said, "I'll show you to the dorms. We start at 6 a.m. And that night, I'd like to tell you that I couldn't sleep because of the midnight sun coming through the window in my room. But I know it was because my stomach was in my throat, wondering what the fuck I was getting myself into. The next day, I found myself in the pitch black, wearing a headlamp, a device I didn't know existed, and elbow deep mixing salmon sperm into buckets of salmon eggs. They would hand me a 3-gallon bucket, and I would insert my arm and slowly mix. Counterclockwise, no more than 5 times. A very precise and important step I had to do just so, obviously mimicking exactly what the salmon would be doing in nature. I would let the bucket sit until the eggs went from being squishy to a firm, plump ball, the perfect gummy bear consistency, to then be poured into the incubation tanks to mature. Now, I had a few country boyfriends when I was in Georgia, so I did handle a few fish, but that summer, I personally fertilized 53 million chum salmon eggs. While singing and laughing next to a friend that I made at the hatchery, James. James was about 9 years older than me, and despite his singular nipple piercing, he seemed to have his head on pretty straight. And we talked over the weeks, and I shared with him how I wanted to stay in Alaska, quit school, and work my way up the ranks to become a hatchery manager. I couldn't imagine going back to boring old Georgia and leaving the wilds of Alaska. James always seemed to really care about my thoughts and what I had to say. And so at one point, he looked at me earnestly and said, "Haley, this will all be here next summer waiting for you." I went back to UGA, and a professor got me involved in research, and I did a study on bass genetics. And then next summer, because of all that experience, I was able to intern in Yellowstone National Park, a place I didn't know existed, and camped for the very first time in my life 6 miles back in the Lamar Valley, where we collected fish for a graduate student doing their research. I froze my ass off every single night in a 40-degree Cabela's sleeping bag that I bought in Georgia. But my headlamp worked perfectly. And at that point, I realized I didn't want to just be involved in research. I wanted to lead research projects. I would have to go to grad school. I applied to multiple master's projects and got into one. But during my master's, I was hospitalized again, and this time my disease was much worse. I had to relearn how to walk, and I couldn't complete my fieldwork. I really had to grapple with whether I'd made the right decision. Maybe I should have gone into fashion and massive amounts of debt. But now I kind of knew that this was my path. So I had to balance my disease with this new dream of becoming a fisheries researcher. And luckily, my doctor found a miracle drug, and my disease went into remission. And I stand before you as a doctor and a biologist, a fish biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. A job 4 years in that still feels like an absolute dream. I get to do research, field work, and advise students. My very first master's student will be graduating in December. I spent this past summer backpacking in the Sierra Nevada and driving across Nevada and Oregon to remote locations to collect stream habitat data, off not seeing anyone but the crew that I was with. I always thought the most wild part of my life would be spent on the streets of New York, dodging people on the sidewalk and elbows on the subway and sucking in tailpipe smoke. And I no longer design clothes, but I still design. I design research projects. And I get to sew together stories about how humans affect our ecosystems and what we can do to keep those ecosystems intact for future generations. I spend my time dodging spider webs and tree branches while breathing in crisp, clean air in the wilds of deserts and forests. But every time I'm in the field, I always think about how I would design my waders differently.
Thanks, Haley. Haley Glasick migrated from her birthplace in Pennsylvania to Georgia, the state, not the country, and eventually to Montana, where she has lived for 8 years. Landing in Missoula has been a blessing for friendship, love, heartbreak, growth, and community. After seeing Tell Us Something in 2022, she has been waiting for a prompt that would fit for her to share a story. Haley was given lots of cheeky feedback from high school friends of how poor a storyteller she is. By sharing this story, she has broken that streak. A mountain guide's attempt to turn an Alaskan fling into a real relationship was ruined by a giant stake and its disastrous aftermath. After his partner abruptly ends things, he has to navigate gossip and miscommunication to try to save their relationship.
I noticed a little green sheen on the surface of that meat. But I just flipped it over and thought, I'll cook it real well.
And a woman overwhelmed by her many responsibilities unexpectedly joins the Peace Corps in Africa.
My favorite trick was the guy who spun plates. He'd have this stick, and he'd get the plate going up there, and he'd get it spinning, and then he'd put it in this matrix. And as that matrix held the plate, he'd keep it going, and he'd get 10 or 12 plates going at one time.
Stay with us. Thank you to the Good Food Store and Exit Realty, who, as story sponsors, helped us pay our storytellers. Learn more about them at goodfoodstore.com and missoularealty.com. Thanks to our stewardship sponsor, Marsh McLennan, who helped us to give away free tickets to underserved populations. Learn more about Marsh McLennan at marshmclennan.com. We are currently looking for storytellers for the next Tell Us Something storytelling event. The theme is a sense of place. If you'd like to pitch your story for consideration, please call 406-203-4683. You have 3 minutes to leave your pitch. Our friends from the deaf community are welcome to pitch by emailing info@tellussomething.org. The pitch deadline is May 21st. I look forward to hearing from you. You are listening to the Tell Us Something podcast, where people share their true personal stories around a theme live in person without notes. I'm Mark Moss. Storytellers in this episode shared their stories in front of a full house on October 7th, 2025, at the George and Jane Dennison Theater in Missoula, Montana. Brian Dalpies hopes to turn his Alaskan summer fling into a real relationship and ignores food safety for a giant steak, which leads to a disastrous morning ritual right outside his would-be love's A-frame door. When his partner abruptly ends things after returning from a grueling trip, he must navigate gossip and miscommunication to save the relationship. Brian calls his story The Rile. Thanks for listening.
It's late August 2012. I'm working as a mountain guide in the quirky little town of McCarthy, Alaska. And I'm living in the dry A-frame of my summer fling, Rachel. Rachel's got this long, perpetually tangled brown hair, these bright brown eyes that when she smiles, she gets this really cute squint. And that smile, it's got its own gravity. It pulls me closer every time she flashes it. And even though Rachel is physically a lot smaller than me, she can carry the same size pack on the most rugged Alaska terrain. She's smart, she's funny, she's beautiful, but what really hooks me is she's so kind. Whether you're a close friend, a total stranger, or one of the random dogs that wanders around McCarthy, Rachel will meet you with kindness and a genuine curiosity about your life. And so, in those days, we didn't have running water or electricity where we were in McCarthy, and the biggest challenge we ran into with that was we couldn't refrigerate our food. You know, eating canned and dried goods every day gets old really fast. And we had a friend visit who, on their way out, they offered all the food left in their cooler. And there were some veggies and some fruit, but what I saw was this massive sirloin steak. And she warned me. She said, you know, our ice melted a day, probably 2 days ago. So be careful with that. I didn't care. It was too tempting. I fired up the grill, got it nice and hot, threw some extra salt on the steak because that should kill some bugs, right? And I slapped that thing on the grate. The aroma was incredible. My mouth was immediately watering. And I will say, I noticed a little green sheen on the surface of that meat. But I just flipped it over and thought, I'll cook it real well. So I munched that thing down. Every bite was a dream. I went to bed that night feeling fat and happy, only to wake up early the next morning with a GI emergency. And so I scrambled out of the loft, down the ladder in the A-frame, burst out the front door, and started the sprint to the nearest outhouse, which was about 100 feet away. I made it 75 of those 100 feet before catastrophically shitting my pants mid-stride. Now, with no electricity or running water, we didn't have, you know, clothes washer or shower, so we'll just say McCarthy Creek and I were well acquainted that day. And I spent the rest of the day very close to the outhouse, needing to use it quite often. And I went to bed that night totally exhausted. The next morning I woke up, and my first thought was, man, I feel pretty good. I think I turned the corner on this. Started down the ladder. All it took was being vertical. And I realized, nope, I'm not through this. Now, From the day before, I knew it wasn't worth trying to outrun, so I just stepped outside the front door, down the couple steps, dropped trowel, and left a massive pile right next to the steps. Rachel had left early that morning to fly out to guide a 5-day backcountry trip. So she wasn't around. I had the day off. And I thought, well, no rush to clean this up. I'll go have a cup of coffee. So I'm having my cup of coffee. I'm looking out the guide's window at the beautiful Alaska Vista. And lo and behold, here comes Rachel trotting past the window towards the A-frame. Uh-oh. So I start chasing after, figuring I have to explain myself. And by the time I catch up, she's already in the A-frame. I come in, she's frantically ripping her clothes off, and she's like, God damn it, fucking Todd, douchebag. I said, what happened? And she said, well, Todd just like winged my bag into the van and exploded my bear spray all over me and all my stuff. So she's in this panic to get changed and repacked so she can guide this trip. So I help her as best I can, and in a flash, she's out the door, she's gone, and I'm left with my thoughts. I hope she's okay. I hope these clients are easy. I hope she has a good trip. Did she see the pile? We'll have to deal with that another day. So 2 days later, I leave for my own 5-day backcountry trip with a friend, and unbeknownst to us, we were attempting a route that hadn't been done in more than 50 years. And over those 5 days, we got what we call Alaska'd. And what that means is whatever harrowing and terrifying experience you imagine the Alaska backcountry could offer, we experienced it. And during that time, all I could think about was Rachel. That squinty smile, that tangly hair. And I realized this summer fling, I really wanted it to be a thing. I wanted to have a life with Rachel. And I was genuinely concerned that I might not make it back to tell her that. But of course, I did. And the plane landed, I hopped in the van, and I rushed down to find her so I could tell her how I feel. And it wasn't hard to do because McCarthy's essentially one dirt road, and she was walking up with two girlfriends. So I pulled over and started peppering her with questions, only to get one word, cold answers. How are you? Fine. What have you been up to? Nothing. Where are you going? Out. Can we talk later? Maybe. I look up at her friends. They've got their arms crossed, and they have these faint kind of snarls on their faces. And one of them turns to Rachel and says, we should go, Rach. And Rachel looks at me and just says, bye, and walks away. So I dejectedly drive down to the guide's quarters, and I haul my gear to the wall tent that I use to store between trips. And as I get in, I see there's a pile of my stuff from the A-frame, my clothes, my books, everything. And on top, there's a note. And it just says, this isn't going to work out. We should end it before we're more entangled. I was gutted. I couldn't understand what was happening. I couldn't compute what I was reading. So I had a very fitful night of sleep that night, and the next morning I went out early to try to find her and see if she would talk to me. And I tracked her down, and she agreed to have a conversation. We found a quiet spot on McCarthy Creek, and I just started rambling. I'm sorry, I didn't want to poop in your yard. I was sick. And she said, what are you talking? This is about you sleeping with the blonde girl. I thought, blonde girl? There's no... Oh, the blonde girl. So the blonde girl was a van tour leader that I was schmoozing at the bar trying to network clients with, a common thing in the guide world. And after a few drinks, I walked her back to her tent, and that was that. What I didn't know is Rachel's friends were in the bar, and after I left, they finish the rest of the night from their imagination. Oh, Rachel says, oh, so you didn't sleep with the blonde girl? I said, no, absolutely not. I want to be with you. I want a life with you. And she said, "Oh my God, yeah, me too. That's why I was so upset. I'm falling for you, and I thought we really had something." I said, "Yeah, we do." And so we had this really excited moment of talking like what the next few months could look like. We could get a place together. We could travel. It was just full of possibility. And after a moment, the energy kind of settled, and we had this very peaceful moment just looking out over the creek, and the leaves were just starting to change colors. McCarthy Creek was just peacefully, you know, burbling right at our feet, and there was this moment of still clarity after so much confusion. After a few moments, Rachel kind of cocked her head at me, and with that squinty little smile, she said, "Wait, you shit in my yard?"
Thanks, Brian. Growing up on the mean streets of suburban Colorado, Brian found refuge in the punk rock and skateboarding communities. While voyaging on the courageous journey from child to man-child, his life course changed when he discovered the moving meditation that is rock climbing. After honing his climbing and alpine skills, he spent summers in Alaska guiding ice climbing, glacier exploration, and backcountry trips. Since those years, he has continued on to be a guide, instructor, coach, firefighter EMT, COVID task force specialist, seedling nursery crew lead, mobile beer canner, freelance video editor, graphic artist, handyman, landscaper, ski patroller, house sitter, marketplace hustler, the list goes on. He is the proud dad of a floppy-eared special needs dog named Ron, who is regularly recognized on the trail and pined over by complete strangers. Closing out this episode of the Tell Us Something podcast is Betsy Funk. Betsy is feeling overwhelmed by her spinning plates of responsibility. Betsy receives an unexpected invitation to join the Peace Corps in Africa. She risks leaving her daughter and draining her finances to chase a desperate call for help, embarking on a journey that will test her limits and change her perspective on what it means to keep life together. Betsy calls her story Mother. Thanks for listening.
So when I was a child, we would watch the television, and some of the shows we watched were variety shows. And the people on variety shows would get on, and they'd sing and they'd dance, and the ones that I liked the most were the ones who did tricks. And my favorite trick was the guy who spun plates. He'd have this stick, and he'd get the plate going up there, and he'd get it spinning, and then he'd put it in this matrix. And as that matrix held the plate, he'd keep it going, and he'd get 10 or 12 plates going at one time. The music would swell. He'd pop that plate off with a stick, and he'd catch it, and he'd go 1, 2, 3 until he had all 12 plates. He'd take a bow. It was magical. So I'm sitting in my classroom during my planning period, and I've got plates spinning. I got plates in this corner and plates down the hall and plates above my head and plates in the storeroom. I got them all going, and I'm hitting a point of too muchery. I'm stuck in too muchery, and I'm not sure how to handle it because I know all of those plates are important for all of the people I care about. And the biggest plate right in the middle is my daughter, who's finishing off her first year of chemotherapy fighting cancer. And I know all the other plates can kind of wobble and I can keep them going, but that plate, that one has to stay spinning as long as it possibly can. And then I hear ding, and I look over at my computer, pause, and see who it is, and it's Sally. Sally's a good friend of mine who played with me in the symphony, and she decided she wanted to take a different tack, and she joined the Peace Corps. And so I hadn't heard from her in about 9 months, and there's this message that says, "Hey, Betsy." I'm like, great, time to take a break from all my plate spinning and see if I can talk to Sally. So we have this conversation. "How are you?" "I'm okay. How are you?" We converse for a while, and then she pops a question. "Hey, Betsy. I got something to ask you." And I go, yeah, sure, what is it? She goes, would you come to Africa? And I went, what? She says, well, I kind of have to teach, and I don't know how, and I'm scared, and would you come and spend 8 weeks in Africa teaching us how to teach? I went, oh, and I thought about my plates. Well, they can wobble, but there was that big plate. I said, hang on. I picked up the phone, and I called Kelsey. I said, hi, Kels. I just got asked a wild question. What is it, Mom? I said, Sally just asked me to go to Africa for 8 weeks. She goes, I said, what do you think? She says, Mom, that's awesome. You should go. I'll never go. You can come back and tell me the stories. So began my first trip overseas. I was a single mom and had very little money, recently married to my husband, and I knew that this was going to cost a lot, but I didn't know how much it was going to cost until I met with the very patient travel agent, and I met with a very kind banker, and I had my very tolerant new husband who said, okay. And about 2 weeks after I found out the price and got all the shots and the paperwork and all of the things that I didn't know you had to do to go to Africa, again, never been overseas, just had a passport, I went to the bank and I got $4,500, walked across the street, and there was a glass front on the travel agency, and I went to go to our appointed appointment to buy my ticket to Africa, and I walked right by the window, and I took my $4,500 and I walked around the block. Came back by the window, and she's looking at me. I kind of look at her, and I walk right by the window, and I head back around the block. What I'm thinking is, all the other plates can wobble, but can I leave Kelsey? Can I go? And what happens if it breaks? And then I think, as I'm on my fourth lap around the block, Kelsey told me to go. I need to bring her back the stories. So I go in. I hand her the money, and she says, we're going to get you to Africa, Betsy. And I said, just be sure you get me home. And so I went to Africa. I went to Ethiopia for 8 weeks, and I worked with the Peace Corps. And during that 8 weeks, I saw the Great Rift Valley. I saw poverty. I experienced extreme generosity. Ethiopian eyes, women winnowing wheat in baskets in the morning light. I tasted, I smelled, I walked, I cried, I felt things that I've never felt before, and I ran away from all the things that I was doing at home to try to find a way to hold it together. And I taught, and I mentored, and I taught. And about 5 weeks in, I get this enlightened young man, his name was Jake. He came up to me, and he was like the poster child for Peace Corps, right? Beautiful teeth, hazel eyes, hair pulled back in a ponytail, chiseled jaw, bare feet. And he goes, I've got an idea. This is 5 weeks in, so I guess he liked me. We're going to take you in the hunt for the mother coffee tree. Now, this is the part of Ethiopia, which I didn't know before I got there, that they had a rainforest. And we're in the rainforest, and we're in the Kaffa region of Ethiopia. And those of you, please excuse me if you know this. I was not prepared for that. So we're in a jungle in the Kaffa region, and they believe in Ethiopia that that's where the mother coffee tree is, where all of our coffee addiction came from, is the Kaffa region of Ethiopia. And so he says, we're going to go and hunt of the mother coffee tree. I said, oh, okay. So we get on a bus, and they bring us to the top of a ridge, sort of looking down on the canopy of the rainforest, and drop us off because it's too dangerous to go farther. The Peace Corps volunteers, three of them, have machetes. Jake is leading us with his bare feet, telling us, Mother Earth is calling me. I know where the coffee tree is. I'm going, okay. And as I look out on the canopy of the rainforest, I see the mist rising in the morning light, illuminating it not unlike the fall mist in the Flathead Valley that rises off the agricultural land as things wake up. And we drop down into the rainforest. And while I'm in the rainforest, down there looking up at the canopy, the light comes in streams and in sparkling spots coming down. It illuminates the Columbus monkey who's watching us in the tree with his big white face and his big bushy long tail and his black body holding court in the jungle. It lights up the baskets that give the promise of sweet honey in the future. It lights up the monkeys that are chasing us and throwing figs at us. It also brings the mid-canopy to life. And in this mid-canopy, it was like there were stars sparkling everywhere you looked. White starred flowers illuminated by this morning light. They were the flowers of the coffee trees. Everywhere you looked, it was a sea of white coffee flowers, everyone holding the promise of a ripe cherry that would then be dried and brought to market in giant bags with giant Ethiopian eyes looking at you. And partway down this jungle journey where they're hacking away, we come to a ravine. And at this ravine, it's about 150 feet deep. There's a long log that goes across and it's slimy. And they say, Jake says, we have to cross the log. The mother coffee tree is calling me through my feet. And I look at the ravine, and I look at the log, I'm like, ooh, I'm twice your age? I don't think so. And the other thing that I don't tell them is when I go down to that log, I realize I can't cross that ravine because I might not make it home, and there's a plate that matters. And so I tell them, I don't think I can cross the log. I think I need to go home. And they say, okay. Taking me back to the village, not knowing what I really mean, is that I have 3 more weeks in Ethiopia, and I want to go home and be with my kid. They take me back to the village, and we've been invited to dinner at an NGO's house, and it's the Italian NGO, and it's a house, it's not a hut, and it's not injera and wat, and it's not a mat on the floor. It's a big table with a kitchen and a generator and a refrigerator and beer. And so we all sit down and they're drinking beer and they're drinking wine, and she brings out papaya and mango and bananas, and all of these things are sweet and tangy and wonderful, and they're eating it and they're excited. And then she brings out bread. Who has bread in Ethiopia? So she brings out loaves of bread, and they're pulling the pieces off, and they're layering the mango and the banana and the pineapple all on the bread. Then she disappears into the kitchen again, and she comes out, she says the pièce de résistance, a giant chunk of Parmesan cheese. Now, we didn't have refrigeration, so some of these kids hadn't had cheese in over 2 years. I hadn't had it for 5 weeks, and I count cheese as a major food group in my life. So I was pretty excited, and so were the kids. And they grated this mound of cheese, and they started layering papaya, mango, banana, bread, cheese, 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 papaya, mango, bread. You get the picture? Then they start putting, when they run out of food, they put it on their hands. They're drinking beer. They put it on their arms, start licking it off each other's faces until they just fall down in a heap of sticky cheese and sugar. And in this place, they had these couches. And I'm watching these kids, and I'm experiencing these young people, knowing that home is calling me. It's saying, you need to go back. You need to stop running away. And I watch these kids, and at the end of it, they go into this couch area, and like only mid-20s people can do, they're a tangle of arms and legs and bodies sort of laying on each other. And I'm heading back to my hut with Sally, and I think to myself, you know, all of this is amazing, and it isn't home, but it's beautiful.
Thanks, Betsy. Betsy Funk is a mom, wife, sister, and friend with a passion for giving back. As a member of our collective community at large, her greatest pleasure is when she is making the world a better place. With a smile, a story, a bouquet, a hug, or a listening ear, she strives to inspire hope in the moments we share. You have been listening to the Tell Us Something podcast. Tune in next week to hear the stories from the self-evident live storytelling event,
where I saw my fellow waiters like me, artists, writers, photographers, actors, dreamers, all waiting for the big break.
I went to the Easter dresses they had, and I was like flipping through dresses. And I turned around. My mom was standing right there, and I was like so scared.
And I knocked on the door, and this big burly guy with dark hair and a tattoo of a grizzly bear and one bicep and a woodpecker on the other opens the door, and he looks at me and he said, "I was wondering when you people would find me."
I read Into the Wild and I just ate that up. Alaska, it wasn't a place, it was an objective. It was traveling west, it was doing more. It was wrapped up in this idea I had of some clarity.
Listen for those stories at tellussomething.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to our media sponsors, MissoulaEvents.net, Mike's Print and Copy, Missoula Broadcasting Company, including the family of ESPN Radio, The Trail 103.3, Jack FM, and Missoula's Source for Modern Hits, U104.5. And thanks to our in-kind sponsors, Float Missoula and Joyce of Tile. Thanks to Cashford Junkers, who provided the music for the podcast. The song is called Buzzin' and can be found on their album, which you can stream at cashforjunkersband.com. Remember that we are looking for storytellers for the next Tell Us Something event. The theme is a sense of place. You can learn about how to pitch your story and get tickets at tellussomething.org.